It's the Skeptic Waves edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, goodbye Neil, climate change, defining the isms, and news about the waves in our movement. Let's begin episode 180.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks, but we are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. You know, Ethan, I was watching the news the other day, and they were talking about this big, you know, gunfight they had in New York around the Empire State Building. And I had to laugh in a way. I mean, it was very sad and tragic what happened. But the bad guy shot one person, and the cops, apprehending the bad guy while killing him, actually ended up shooting, what was it, almost a dozen people or something like that? It's amazing when, you know, those who are in authority and power make a screw-up. Have we had any big screw-ups here at CITR?
And not quite. So we've had a few problems here, but nothing on that quite magnitude of people being shot. However, listeners may have noticed that there were some technical problems last week. CITR had a server crash, and this wiped out the podcast history. Now, fortunately, we are prepared for just such an occasion. You can download all our episodes at radiofreethinker.com, and of course, we will be re-uploading our lost episodes back to our feed so you can continue to get your great Radio Free Thinker content on iTunes or your RSS feed.
Actually, Ethan, just to clarify, we've got about the last 30 or 40 episodes on our site. Before that, we trusted CITR, but you know, we have learned in the past that they quite often lose things and episodes will, well, pass away.
Yeah, so we'll do what we can to collect past episodes and get them back online. But for the meantime, you know, don't worry. We will have you covered for your Radio Free Thinker content in the interim period. But moving on with the rest of the show, we actually have some more sad news, unfortunately. And that, of course, is the death of Neil Armstrong. He passed away last week. Neil Armstrong, the first human on the moon, he passed away from complications relating to heart surgery on August 25th. Now, Armstrong, for pretty obvious reasons, has an assured legacy that will no doubt be remembered for a long, long time. I mean, being the first human on another world is sort of a big deal. The interesting thing about Armstrong, well, were some of the more lesser-known items in his career. Now, I mean, we all sort of know that Armstrong was a pretty humble guy. One thing that you may not realize, though, is that when NASA put together the team for Apollo 11, they were very, very careful about picking the man who would be, you know, the first human on the moon. They wanted to make sure that they didn't get, you know, an egotistical, typical fighter pilot type guy. They took a lot of time in figuring out who was the most down to earth, pardon the pun, of these astronauts that could lead the mission. And Armstrong fit that category like a glove. He was typically, or untypically, I guess you could say, a really low-key guy. And can you consider his accomplishments being on the moon, you know, for goodness sake, he didn't seem to ham it up very often. Now, the level-headedness of Armstrong could be seen in his sort of, you know, nonchalant attitude when he found out, along with the rest of the crew, that they were going to be the team to go to the moon. He reportedly didn't react at all, but just sort of said, "Okay," and they got on with it. And another really cool story that I found out is that Armstrong actually almost died. He was testing a lunar lander, and there's videos of this on YouTube. The thing looks like a sort of pre-Wright Brothers flying machine. It kind of flips through the air and then flies out of control and crashes onto the ground and explodes in this massive fireball. And Armstrong managed to eject at the last moment. You see his parachute and him sort of land. And he was just like, oh, okay, that didn't work. And so he just goes back to work, you know, does some paperwork. And everyone was like, you know, Neil, do you want to take the day off maybe or something? And there he was just like, nah, you know, very level-headed guy.
You know, it's funny, too, and just along that same theme, people may not remember because most of us weren't, you know, alive at the time, that when the lunar lander went to land on the moon, it couldn't land in its regular place. So he had to actually sort of take over control and find a safe landing place for them. And people had asked him, you know, like he only had 25 seconds worth of fuel before they actually did the touchdown. He said, well, you know, didn't that make him nervous? And he said, well, you know, in practice, I usually had about 15 seconds left. It was just sort of like, you know, like, this is just day at the work, not much.
Exactly. Yeah. So the humbleness of Armstrong, that was something that he maintained throughout his life. Very soft-spoken. He didn't get involved in politics, and unlike his fellow astronauts, many of them did go into politics. He was approached by both political parties, I mean, because of his fame and all that, but he never really got involved. The other thing that was interesting that I found out is that he was a deist. He wasn't, you know, a god guy. He was a very, I guess you could say, liberal religious person. You know, a lot of people would pay lip service to religion by calling themselves a deist, even though they might have been an atheist. So that's always interesting to hear. And then I found another really interesting story about Armstrong. He was involved in an accident. His wedding ring got stuck in the wheel of a grain truck, and it tore off the end of his finger.
Ouch.
Yeah. And in a typical Armstrongian way, he just picked up the severed finger, packed it in ice, and most likely really calmly walked into the hospital like nothing happened, and then they had it reattached.
Although, of course, this does lead to, you know, everyone at the hospital were offended because, I mean, he literally gave them the finger.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that I heard about Armstrong is that he used to tell really unfunny jokes about the moon and then say, I guess he had to be there.
That's classic.
Yeah. Now, obviously, it's really sad that he's passed away, and it's kind of ironic that it comes so soon after Curiosity's successful landing on the moon. I mean, really, it makes you wonder about the future of space exploration by humans, and I actually saw an interesting quote from Neil deGrasse Tyson, who he suggested that the first human-piloted craft to Mars should be called the Armstrong, which I thought was a really poetic way you know, enshrining Armstrong's legacy.
I would agree.
Yeah. And when we consider his accomplishments, everything that he's done, and, you know, the fact that he remained so humble, you know, it's interesting. He's such a different kind of explorer. And what I mean by that is if you think of other explorers in human history, the Columbus, the Cortez, the Magellan, I mean, these are the people who really only come close to the accomplishments that Armstrong did. And you look at all those men and what they stood for, and arguably, they stood for pretty horrible things. And the things that they did as explorers were not terribly noble. Whereas Armstrong, I mean, he represented a departure from that mold.
Well, so, and let's clarify, when you were referred to, you know, Columbus, Cortez, Magellan, because, I mean, these were imperialistic, right? I mean, they went there to conquer people. They killed people. They resulted in millions of deaths, either accidental or on purpose.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Columbus enslaved the first people he met. Like, this is there's certainly a different mind space. And a part of this, of course, is the nature of the times. But even during Armstrong's day, you know, at the height of the Cold War, you know, people always say that the Apollo missions, it was all about getting to the moon first. And sure enough, that was true. But they couldn't have picked the worst person in the world for a plant your flag and do a victory lap, because Armstrong would never do that, right?
It would have been interesting if there were people on the moon. You're saying he's the one guy who would not have enslaved them.
Yeah. I think Armstrong represented a departure from some of our some of the more famous explorers of our time. I mean, even if you look at some of the more modern ones, you know, like the Shackletons and such, even they, I mean, they explored for the purpose of expanding the boundaries of a map. Whereas I think Armstrong, especially with his famous quotations, he was there for, you know, the advancement of a human frontier. And in many ways, I think as skeptics and humanists, that's what we want to see and explore, not there to conquer, but expand the frontiers of humanity, of a shared frontier and a shared cultural heritage of exploration and, you know, uncovering the mysteries of the universe. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, I think I would agree, and although I would maybe put a different spin on this. I mean, one of the other famous stories about Neil Armstrong is the fact that he sort of became, to a degree, sort of reclusive, and he wouldn't even sign autographs because he was offended that people were selling them. And I don't judge that as a bad thing. I think he has that right. But in some ways, if he was a bit more of the wave the flag, you know, do the little dance, that in some ways it could have, you know, made science more popular. It could have made people, I mean, he did it. I mean, everyone is quite famous, but if there was a bit more of a cheerleaderness to it, I mean, it is great. And another interesting aspect about this is that he's actually also the first civilian on the moon. Everyone else but one other moonlander was actually part of the military as well as part of NASA. So in that sense, it's a very good sort of message to send. Well, this is a civilian message, not a militaristic sort of conquest, as you were mentioning. With the passing of Neil Armstrong, and within the next 10 to 20 years, all the people who have been on the moon will be dead. I mean, they were all born in the 1920s and 30s. They're in their 70s and 80s. They're not long here. And soon, for the first time in four, maybe five generations, there will not be a human on the planet who has been an extraterrestrial, who's been off of the planet on another body in the solar system. They're disappearing. And with that seems to be some of the greatness that was humanity. Some of this new frontier that Armstrong was responsible for creating seems to be also decaying. And that just strikes me as very, very sad.
Well, you know, the other factor to that is several countries do have, at least in... are saying, maybe it's lip service, maybe it's not, that they do have plans to go to the moon. China has mentioned this, and there are other nations, up-and-coming nations like India and others, that do want to go to space. Now, I mean, it could just be a Western bias, but I'm a little concerned that China's motivations might be more for that victory lap than it is for exploration. And I mean, my concern is that this is something that Neil deGrasse Tyson actually mentioned when we interviewed him, that if China has ambitions to go to the moon, that will motivate America and other countries to want to go to the moon. But that's for the, I think, a really silly and ultimately damaging motive. That's just another race to plant a flag and have a victory lap. And really, that's not helping anyone. And what are the odds that we're going to find another Armstrong, another kind of, you know, person who can, you know, exemplify these great traits of not going there for the glory and the, you know, planting of the flag.
And it also points to another thing, in a way, this sort of, you know, having reached a peak and sort of slowly decaying, and not decaying, it's more like a slowdown in the acceleration of advancement, that we had the International Space Station, which is by and large an international project. I mean, most of the countries that are capable of developing space technology have their hand in it. Right now, I mean, the partnership sort of between the United States and Russia is extreme with regards to the space station, because the Americans can't get there and the Russians can. And it seems like that was almost the pinnacle of humanity going into space. And as you're mentioning, you know, as China goes and India goes, Japan may go, the Americans may return, Russians may return, but doing so as my nation will do this thing and claim this land for my nation seems to be an abandonment of that sort of humanist sort of globalism that seems to have envisioned the landing on the moon. I mean, one of the great things about Armstrong and his great line, you know, one small step for man, one giant step for mankind, not one giant step for the U.S. And everyone in the world could sort of take part and take ownership of this great achievement. And again, that the future of that's up in the air.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously, really sad to see Neil go. But like I said, his legacy assured. And it'll be up to, I think, the skeptics and the fans of science and space exploration to maintain that legacy and to encourage that sense of exploration in the next generation to boldly go where Neil Armstrong has gone before.
Exactly. When we come back, we're going to do a little bit about climate change and then a whole bunch of stuff about isms.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
So as I was mentioning before the break, we're going to talk about climate change and its causes. And have we sort of proven that climate change is responsible for this, that, and the other? Now, as we know, there's been a lot of sort of that hemming and hawing about whether any particular climate event can be tied to climate change. You'll often hear in the news a reporter ask, so is this hurricane caused by climate change? Then, of course, you get some sort of tortuous answer from a climate scientist saying, well, we cannot attribute any single weather event to climate change, but it only increases the likelihood and intensity of such events. Now, recently, James Hansen published a paper in the Proceedings of National Academy of Science where essentially he said, yes, it was caused, and we can kind of prove it. Now, to be fair, his proof is more of the kind of saying that, you know, does cigarette smoking cause cancer? And we say yes. So we're still left with the sort of thing that, well, we can't attribute any single event, but we can now sort of show in a much more explicit sense that particular climate events are causally linked to climate change. Now, to do this, what he did was he and his colleagues took about 60 years worth of information, basically from the middle of the last century to 2011. And he got air temperature analysis from the Goddard Institute. He took this analysis and he divided the planet into a bunch of squares, roughly 250 kilometers across. He recorded temperatures for each one of these squares. And then he sort of broke up all this data into big blocks of about six decades long. So 10 years of this, 10 years of this, and he compared them on sort of a bell curve. They looked in particular at 3 months, which constituted the summer in the Northern Hemisphere. First, they sort of created a reference value for each cell. That is sort of the average that you would expect. And he based that from 1951 to 1980. Then they calculated how much, you know, each cell deviated from this sort of reference value in each of the decades. So based on the average from the 1950-1980, they then went back to say, well, from 1951 to 1959, how much for each year, for each segment, did it deviate from the norm? And then he plotted these on a chart. And you have these sort of bell curves. And if you look at the bell curves, there's sort of two trends. You kind of get the first one, which sort of shows the peak over time, which constantly moves to the right, and the right means warmer and more warmer temperatures. And you also notice the curves get flatter, which means that the deviation from the norm becomes larger. Essentially what he has shown, and I mean, for those of us who know the science, it's like, well, duh, I knew this already. It put it in a much more intuitive way to look at, and it's a statistical analysis in the same sense that we can say, listen, this cancer, cigarettes cause cancer, climate change caused that hurricane. If you take a look at the graph, like I say, the deviations, remember that they were talking about the standard deviation they needed for certainty with regards to the Higgs boson. They wanted five standard deviations. Well, this one here shows about two deviations, which granted, I mean, five would have been even better, but if it had been five, that means our temperatures would have been skyrocketing. We have to admit there's a certain degree here. But you also notice the degree of deviations lower. What that essentially means is in any particular year, you tend to have record cold levels and you have record hot levels, and they will tend to balance themselves out, and you get a nice steep bell curve with the average sort of being in the middle. As this curve flattens out, that means you tend to get much higher extremes on both ends, right? So you tend to get like really, really cold and really, really hot. The graph moving to the right means you tend to get a lot more of the hot days than cold days. So again, the United States right now is suffering from a huge drought. Essentially, Hansen's come out and said, well, listen, this data proves this drought was caused by climate change. Now again, scientifically speaking, you can't really come out and say that, but it is adding a lot more to the weight of the argument that, hey, we're taking a causal link and we're saying statistically this is causal, not correlation. Ethan, any thoughts on this one?
Well, I kind of have to agree, though. I mean, like, it's not, you can't really say it's cause. I mean, you can't really say that Hurricane Isaac was, you know, quotations, caused by climate change, because we know how hurricanes form. So it's not, but you can say, I think, with some certainty that Hurricane Isaac may have been made worse by climate change, because we know that climate change, you know, affects X, Y, and Z. And we know that these variables, when taken as in a systematic way, will have an effect on the variables that create hurricanes, and that will create, you know, more dangerous hurricanes that will have an impact on droughts and other extreme climate. But I mean, to say that it's caused, I think, is actually kind of a misnomer. It's not really accurate. It's not like the climate change generates a new hurricane. It's that the climate change effects on the environment will augment the natural formation of extreme weather and make it worse. So I'm a little skeptical. Well, not skeptical. I'm a little bit hesitant with that kind of language for this.
Well, I think there's two ways to look at this. I mean, in the one sense, and again, I'm going to keep using the analogy of smoking and cancer, is that you are right that it's hard to say that, hey, this particular cancer was caused by cigarette smoking. But it is the point now where you can say that the prevalence of cancer in this community is caused by smoking. So the prevalence of extreme weather events is caused by climate change. Even if, again, you can't say this one was for sure caused by climate change, but climate change was definitely a contributing factor to the point where that if there was no climate change, the odds of this event occurring would A, diminish significantly, and B, being as extreme as it was, would not have been as extreme. So I think he's making a good causal claim in that sense, and I agree with you that he's not making the causal claim that Isaac was caused by climate change. He's saying that Isaac and Glenda and whatever the other ones are this time, the fact that we have 7 hurricanes this year, although actually, oddly enough, I think hurricanes aren't one of the factors that are integrated with the climate change, but we'll pretend for the moment that it does. That the fact that we had 7 this year and only 3 a decade ago, that is the effect of climate change, that we can see it, and it is a causal link in the sense that there are more and they are bigger. So I think one of the other factors that plays into this, because we could sort of debate some of the issues, but one of the reasons Hansen has been so extreme in his pushing of this event is that he sees it as if we don't do something, it will be the end of the world. People aren't listening. Therefore, I must use language that is very highly rhetorical, but it seems to be the only language to get through. Now, I know this has a double-edged sword, because if you use too high of a rhetorical language, people will tend to turn off, or they will dismiss the entire movement because, hey, listen, this guy went off his hat. But I mean, we have found in our own little community that sometimes extremist language on one side or the other has an effect and sometimes is necessary in order to get things to move.
You know, all this talk about causes and, you know, the definitive terminology here about what causes what has me wondering if there was a way that we could definitively answer these questions about what does it mean to say what evidence caused something, and whether that cause was actually a cause or actually a contributing factor. Is there any kind of field of methodology that investigates such terminology?
Is this a segue to skepticism?
It is a segue to skepticism. Everything I say is a segue to skepticism. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, this might be a good point to take a bit of a pause.
Canada pays some of the highest cell phone fees in the industrialized world. And now the big three companies that control 94% of the market want us to pay more? Using high-priced lobbyists, the big three are trying to trick the government into shutting out independent competitors. If they succeed, they will squeeze more money out of your wallet and squeeze Canadians into tighter contracts. Send a message to the industry minister. We want competition. We want independent providers. Stand up. Sign this urgent petition. Visit stopthesqueeze.ca.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR, of course. So there's been a lot of discussion of isms and all this terminology. So, Don, tell us a little bit about what are these terms that we use, atheism, skepticism, humanism? What do they mean? Why do we use them? What's the point?
Yes, well, I guess I should preface this by saying that in order to have a rational discussion, and in philosophy, definitely so, you need to kind of have a definition of the terms you're using. Now, I'm not going to be, you know, the God definer here and say that what I'm defining is the absolute right way to do it. But I want people to know that when I start talking about these particular topics, this is how I define them. You may disagree with my definition, but you know what I'm talking about, even if you would want to change the word. So one of the big ones that's been big in the community lately, and I mean, a lot of this has come out because, you know, the there's been debates about atheism, skepticism, humanism, socialism, and words they've attached to it, waves and pluses and such. So what do these words sort of mean? So atheism is essentially a belief system about the existence or non-existence of a supernatural entity. One can be an atheist simply because you've never been exposed to any religion. Equally, you could be agnostic. That's what I would call a weak atheist, because you think, you know, the question is sort of beyond a certainty of knowledge, best left answered as I don't know. Some will be atheists because of sort of a contradiction of theory and practice. I'm sure a number of Catholics, for example, lost their faith because they couldn't reconcile sort of a loving God / church and pedophilic priests. I think I would count someone like Ian Harris Ali, one of our awful atheists from episode 177, in this category. And of course, there are those who look at the evidence and conclude that there is no scientific or weight of evidence to believe. Now, of course, you could be an atheist for several or all of these reasons, but that's roughly how I see, you know, atheism. Skepticism is quite different in many ways. Skepticism to me isn't so much a belief, but a theory of knowledge. It's not so much, as I say, belief in itself, but a mechanism for selecting beliefs, for truths, for facts. The original philosophical skeptics questioned if knowledge was possible for humans, that humans could actually make any kind of truth claim. And if you think about sort of the Matrix, you know, how do you know that you're not a brain in a jar sort of thing? And philosophically, you know, you couldn't say anything with certainty. Now, of course, this was based on a very strong logical foundation. Although it was very strong and there was a lot of certainty sort of in its uncertainty, there's a certain pragmatic sense where you kind of want to bite the bullet and assert something and then build your picture of the world upon this.
It pragmatically fell apart, basically.
Essentially. I mean, it was good, but it didn't carry much weight.
Yeah.
So then you would have sort of, you know, what I call theistic or rational skeptics. Those are people like Thomas Aquinas and Descartes, who, I mean, I disagree with some of their conclusions, but they're actually, they moved us beyond sort of the ancient skeptics. So they sort of accepted the logic of the ancients, but acknowledged that a rejection of any knowledge seemed sort of irrational. So choosing to take a pragmatic route, they needed to add to their world a foundation, a rational rock upon which to build knowledge. Now, of course, they chose God as their foundation. And it wasn't really until you had like Francis Bacon and the Scientific Revolution of the Enlightenment that scientific skepticism even became possible. So scientific skepticism has its foundations in the scientific method. When combined with logic and reason, we get a powerful sort of self-correcting tool to filter competing ideas from the world around us. Are you still with me, Ethan?
Yeah, I'm on board with that. Although, I mean, I get a little bit prickly when people mention Aquinas and Descartes as skeptics, but nevertheless.
Well, yeah, maybe we'll debate that after I finish my little list here. So humanism is essentially a philosophy about how we should treat ourselves and our fellow humans. Its foundation is largely Epicurean in nature, which essentially said that, you know, humans are the best measure of good, and that through moderation and education, we become the best judges of good. There is sort of a rejection of the supernatural or otherworldliness as our masters. Humanism in the Renaissance could be compatible with religious beliefs. Modern secularism, of course, sort of presupposes atheism, although belief in an impersonal deity is possible. For example, Neil Armstrong's deists could be a secular humanist. There isn't really a logical incompatibility with that. Secular humanism, of course, attempts to move beyond atheism in the sense that it's trying to provide an ethical framework in a sort of post-religious society. I mean, atheism essentially denies a supernatural deity. Humanism sort of comes in and says, well, then how should we build a ethical and moral society? So the context, in a modern context, though, we've actually had more of a focus on the secular as opposed to the humanism, because in the sense that they're trying to remove religion from the public forum. In this form, humanism often finds itself allied with things like Unitarians and other sort of secular religious movements who see faith as more personal and not a public exercise. Still on board?
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, I've heard the argument that modern-day secular humanism sort of precludes the modern day secular humanism assumes atheism on the part of the participant. I'm skeptical of that claim, to mix metaphors. And part of the reason is because, you know, I've been fairly involved in the sort of organized route of skepticism and humanism, and I've encountered a lot of humanists who flat out reject the notion that you need to be an atheist to be a humanist. And I've encountered it enough times that I would say that it's not, I wouldn't even say that the majority of quote-unquote secular humanists are atheists. Now, I mean, people are free to disagree with me on that, and I will fully accept that it's just an anecdote, but that's my personal take on it, at least.
Well, you know, it's funny, actually, right outside my SkyTrain station is a building that is the Buddhist humanism, it's a sort of society, you know, and I think one of the things is that there are the humanist movement itself, in attempting to create the big tent, has sort of lowered its requirements for admission, so to speak. I think, you know, they say, well, if you agree with us that there shouldn't be any religion in government, that your belief system is your belief system and shouldn't be pushed on anyone else. You acknowledge that science is science, and you know, there's a certain number of criteria that are not necessarily contradictory to a lot of people's religious beliefs, that they will let you into their tent. And in that sense, you know, they're trying to build upon. But again, it makes what technically is secular humanism not really applicable to the humanist movement as we see it now. Sorry, Ian, you're going to write in and yell at me for saying that, and you might have a chance to rebuttal if you wish.
Well, I mean, he may have a point. And the thing is, too, though, I mean, like, we sometimes forget that the humanism began as a very religious movement, and that it was about reforming religion. I mean, I wrote about this myself in a blog post on Skeptic North. Humanism turned religion around. I mean, religion was a very top-down, do what we say or we will burn you mentality. Humanism, and you can argue whether it was successful, really started to turn religion into that kind of, you know, religion is about peace and love and faith and camaraderie and all this, you know, hoity-toity BS. humanism was sort of, it defanged a lot of the vitriol that existed in religion. I mean, now that has, of course, regained a lot of momentum with the rise of fundamentalism and whatnot. But humanism was, in many ways, a very tempering force in the early or the late Renaissance and eventually onto the Enlightenment. I mean, humanism was what you called yourself if you didn't think you should burn somebody alive. Like, that was an important factor of humanism, right?
Yeah, actually, and this will tie into another one of the isms that I'm writing about, but maybe is a bit of a horseshoe into this, is the idea of socialism. Now, socialism, again, is sort of a belief that strength and prosperity is more completely attained through social cooperation. Socialists to this day come from all points of the religious spectrum. Unlike the other isms we discussed, socialism isn't so much individualistic, but it sort of presupposes a groupthink attitude that one could be individually an atheist, skeptic, or even a humanist, but you couldn't be a singular and socialist at the same time. That would make you a libertarian. And I think maybe that's one of the areas where humanism has crossroads with a lot of the or has potential on other things, is it is a lot about the we instead of the I. And I think a lot of the other movements tend to get I first and we second.
Well, I've heard from many people when I attend conferences and whatnot, skeptic, humanist, or otherwise, that the vibe that I often hear from people is that I hate using these kind of terminology, that organized skepticism and that it is different from organized humanism is that the skeptic movement is more right-wing and the humanism movement is more left-wing. Now, I don't really buy that, but I have heard that again many times from people, that skepticism is more has a more libertarian bent than humanism does.
Well, you know, this might be a good point to take a bit of a pause, go have a coffee, take a deep breath, and when we come back, we'll talk about the new direction of atheism or skepticism, however you choose to parse it, when we come back.
Standing on a planet, really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Okay, and we're back. Now, I've kind of given you a rough definition. We've kind of stressed out some of the ism words that will be thrown around. But there's been a lot of talk about things like atheism plus and the fourth wave skepticism. Ethan, you've done a bit more research into this, a bit more writing about this. What is this all about, and what does it? Where does it take us?
Well, I mean, it's a good question, because the thing with atheism plus, and if you're not familiar with this, this was an idea that was sort of envisioned by Jen McCrite over at Freethought Blogs, and has sort of been fermenting amongst some of the more progressive bloggers there, like Greta Christina, P.Z. Myers, and others. And the idea behind this is a form of atheism that may take the form of an organization or group or subgroup or quote-unquote movement, depending on who you ask, that is explicitly and going to be actively participating in social justice and civil liberties. Now, of course, this sounds like a good idea. Some people have said, well, wait a second, though, isn't that just secular humanism rebranded? And some people have said, well, wait a second, I call myself a skeptic, but I also think that social justice, et cetera, are really important causes. And some people have said, well, wait a second, I call myself an atheist, and I don't want my word rebranded to mean X, Y, and Z. So there's been a lot of talk about words, terminology, and how people identify themselves. Now, we can sort of debate the different levels of that argument and its meta forms. Now, my personal take, and I think that it's no surprise, we've discussed this many times here on the show, that skepticism for me, and I think Don as well, would basically include a skeptical approach to atheism, humanism, religion, politics, social justice, and everything in between, because we don't really hold back our critical thinking when it comes to discussing important topics. We make sure that when we talk about everything from gun control or decriminalization of prostitution, that we're being critical thinkers. The counter argument is, well, you know, I can take homeopathy into a laboratory and look at it under a microscope. I can examine the supposed hairs of Bigfoot. I can examine a photograph of UFOs, but I can't really drag policy into a laboratory and study it. So how can we be skeptical of social justice issues? Now, Don, what do you think about that?
Well, I think in the one sense that what you're referring to is you get a large degree of certainty when you deal with, you know, the classic sort of skeptical issues. But when you go to social scientists, you know, like I say, policy, you don't tend to get the black or white. But we've talked about on this show that there actually is a lot of empirical evidence that you can use to sort of say, well, this particular social policy is much more effective than this other social policy. And as such, we can say that in general, this is going to be better than that, even if it isn't quite as, well, this is true and that's false. It's more of a shade of gray, but there are different shades of gray, and you can use your tools to make appeals in these areas. So I think we agree on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the problem is that there are certain individuals out there who believe that skepticism, I guess we could call it capital S skepticism, can really only be applied to certain topics of science. And that's well and good. And there are certain people out there who believe that atheism is, of course, the most important cause to investigate. Some people think that skepticism is the most important cause to investigate. Now, I mean, whether or not we agree or disagree with those kind of claims, the problem that we have right now is that instead of simply saying, okay, well, the atheist plusers are going to focus on atheism and social justice, people are getting up in arms about this. And they're saying, not only are they co-opting our word, which I think is odd in the first place, but they're damaging the movement. They're mission drift. They're splitters. They're like that skit in Monty Python. And, you know, that's bad. And my personal take on that is, are you crazy? What are you talking about? And the reason I say that is because the number one issue that every single one of us, whether we call ourselves an atheist, a skeptic, a humanist, or a bright, or whatever, is that we think the world would be a little bit better if we're a little bit more rational. And how do we get people to be more rational? Well, we convince them to be more rational. It sounds simple, and it is. Because we need people in our movement. And we need people, whether or not they identify themselves as an atheist or a skeptic, we need them. And we need them for battles of secularism. We need them for battles of skepticism. And if Atheism Plus brings in more people into our movement, that's more people who might show up at a skeptics in a pub. That's more people who may say, well, I've read all of Dawkins' work, now I'm going to read some of Carl Sagan's work. And that's more people who are going to say, you know, I'm coming at this movement because I'm interested in social justice, and I'm an atheist, but I don't really know anything about atheism. And they're going to read some of the, you know, really important skeptical atheist books out there, and they're going to find themselves, and they're going to say, "Wow, I'm really on board with this movement." And rather than looking at it as a splitting or an offshoot, look at it as a bigger way to reach more people, and that's the way I'm looking at it. Now, I may not be the only person who has an opinion on this, so I'll throw things over to Don here. What do you think about that?
Well, I think we have a schism in the show, Ethan. This is one of those weird cases where, in some ways, I mean, who could really argue with some of the goals and some of the plans, practical actions of sort of the A plus movement. But for myself, I think at least originally, and now movements will tend to take on a life of themselves and may change. But having read the blog post from Jen and those other ones, and I don't want to rehash too much here, but it was actually intended to be exclusionary, not inclusionary. It was like, well, the old movement had a bunch of these people who we think are not good people, so we're going to create a new movement and not let them into our clubhouse. And that's why I will have a bit of negative attitude towards the A+. Now, that being said, you are right. You know, I mean, the movement needs to move on. I'm not a big fan of using the term atheist for practical reasons. And forgive me for being a Scotchman on this one, if you understand the logical fallacy here. But I think atheism itself, I mean, a true atheist not only denies God, but does so because of the applications of the skeptical toolkit. That skepticism is a methodology for approaching truth, it's one of the achievements of sort of the second wave. I mean, prior to that, you know, a lot of people can be atheists, but they're not always atheists for good reasons. They're actually atheists based on faith. And again, we talked about in our bad atheists about some people who do that. So I'm not a big fan of using the atheist term in and of itself, because I think it puts emphasis on the wrong part of the movement. In fact, a lot of the people who've been causing dissension within the skeptical movement are atheists who are also racist, as well as, of course, the sexists that are in the movement. And I think, you know, that if you were a true skeptic, then you wouldn't be able to do that because it would create a cognitive dissonance in your brain. And that, you know, if we apply the idea of skepticism to its logical ends, it would not only cure up the problem in atheism, but it would allow skepticism itself to move on. I mean, one of the things that I've mentioned before and I'm writing about is that we want to tackle all of these sort of social issues. And again, I am all for that. We have not talked about that too little on this show. But at the same time, as an internal movement, how can we honestly make recommendations about how the world should be when we within our own movement don't acknowledge the equality of people who are within our own movement? So, you know, I agree. We need a lot of work, and I like the practical actions of the A+ movement, but I don't like the fact that it does seem to be a splintering and not an augmentation. But as I said, maybe the movement will supersede its origination and become a bigger vacuum for the people with lacking skeptical skills to come into the movement.
Well, to address some of those points, the original idea behind Jen sort of starting her own group, movement, whatever you want to call it, related to the issue that she had been trying for many years, as have others, to expand the frontiers of what skeptics talk about, whether that's talking about feminism or talking about social justice. And the resistance that she was getting was not just in the form of sort of a finger wag saying, you know, you're not supposed to be doing this or you're doing it wrong, but it was also coming in the form of really violent, aggressive behavior, menacing behavior, threats, rape threats, etc. And, you know, like, as I wrote in my post on Skeptic North about this, I don't even consider those people relevant. I don't want them in my movement. If you make a rape or death threat, bye.
I don't think we disagree on that part.
Yeah, slam the door in their face. They're gone. So part of it was, I think, Jen and others basically said, you know what? I'm tired of being the only woman at a conference. I'm tired of trying to get people to talk about social justice. I'm tired of defending feminism and having people say to me, you know, how can you call yourself a humanist and a feminist? Feminists just hate men, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to start a group that states as its mandate, we are going to talk about social justice. And if you're not on board with that, don't get involved. I don't have a problem with that. I don't think that's excluding. Like, because, I mean, if that's being exclusive, then every other skeptical organization that has a mandate is also being exclusive. Because CFI, for example, has the dual mandate of promoting skepticism and promoting humanism. So you know going in that if you're one of those people who say, I only want to talk about science, you're going to encounter some frustrations. Likewise, the JREF very clearly says, we are about the science. We are about the skepticism. And if you go into the JREF and say, hey, let's talk about humanism, let's talk about secularism, they're going to say, well, no, we're a skeptic organization. That's very clearly laid out. So, I mean, yes, it on the surface, it appears that Atheism Plus might be a bit exclusive, but it's no more exclusive than any of the other skeptical organizations that exist out there.
What I worry about this is that in the effort to apply genuine social reforms and using skepticism as its tool, which again, I think it's odd that they're using atheism instead of skepticism, but forgive that for the moment, that I am worried that, I mean, right now, I am worried about what I'm going to say. I mean, I have never given a death threat to someone, but I think some of the rhetoric that has gone on has been extreme and has been damaging to the movement. Not that it shouldn't have been said. It needs to be said. But it shouldn't be said as a separate entity. It needs to be said as part of the thing. I mean, how long did it take people in the Democratic Party to promote their own political agenda in the United States? I mean, the Democratic Party is now quite largely a party for blacks and minorities. But if you go back into the 50s and 40s, it was the Republicans who were like that. And you need to put up the fight. And, you know, if Jen sits there or anyone else has death threats against them, there's zero tolerance for that. But if there's someone who says, well, I don't know if we need this, or I disagree that every joke is a sexist joke, and that it's not sometimes funny. There's education involved in that, because, I mean, again, that's a very gray area. But there seems to be a conflation of the extremists who do the death threats with people who are not extremists, who are just not ready to move along yet and need to be pushed along but are not there yet. And this somehow says, no, all of them, we don't want any of them in. And that's where the exclusionary aspect comes into it for me.
But I think that exists with other groups as well. Like, I'm pretty sure that...
I'll go with that. But do we need another exclusionary group?
Well, I don't see it as exclusionary. I see it as, first of all, if you're not on board with the Atheism Plus thing, then don't sign up for Atheism Plus. If you're not interested in a dual-mandated organization, don't join CFI. And if you're not interested in an organization that focuses on magic and skepticism, don't join the JREF. I mean, no one's holding a gun to your head. There are plenty of organizations out there that, you know, focus on your particular focus of whatever it is you want to talk about. There are enough of them for all of us. Now, whether or not you want to join one of them or whether or not you don't want to join any group,
But doesn't that run one risk? And I say this word with some trepidation, but doesn't then we have A plus become feminist atheism? And in that sense, it doesn't actually move the ball forward for the whole movement as a general, but it becomes sort of ghettoized.
I think it's already ghettoized. Like, I mean, if you look at the feminist bloggers who are out there, they're not just being attacked by the crazies. They're being attacked by other well-recognized and well-known skeptics. You know, it's no secret that Penn Jillette, for example, has made some really misogynistic comments about some of the female skeptics in the movement. They've been attacked by lots of different people. Like, these aren't just cranks who are sending death threats.
Well, hold on. I can see. Now, this is one of the things that I worry. So, do you honestly think that Penn Jillette is going to go and rape the Jen? I mean, is that a serious statement? I mean, I agree. He says misogynist things. His views on women are atrocious. But that's where you get the conflation between people who are genuinely dangerous against those people who are stupid and need to grow up.
Well, what's the point, though? I mean, like, if you're saying stupid things, why do we want you around?
Because how are you ever going to learn the right things?
Well, I guess that's sort of how anyone learns, isn't it? I mean, if you go up to a group of people and start, like, slapping them and punching them, are they going to, like, sort of stand there and be like, you know, I'm sorry, this is not how you behave? They're going to be like, you know, get out of here. And you're going to have to learn pretty quickly that that's not how you interact with people.
Well, again, we're talking words, which I know words are hateful, and I'm not discrediting that. But, I mean, if Penn yells at them, she can yell at them back. And ideally, again, if they are the true skeptics, which is why I think skepticism is the place for this, one argument will definitely win out.
That's what they've been doing, though. Like, that's exactly what's been happening for the past, like, 3 years. That's elevator gate in a nutshell. And I don't think it's resolved anything.
See, and I think it has, because we're having this conversation. It's an ugly conversation at times. It's a frustrating conversation. And I understand and I can appreciate the courage and conviction it takes for people who are sort of feminist and in the movement to put up with the bullshit that goes on. And more power to them, and I can support them however I can. But every movement goes through this phase. That's all.
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't think we're that far apart on this. I think it's more of a matter of the finer points. But I think that we both would agree that some of the rhetoric that's been thrown around about this is really not worth the air that it takes up to say it. I mean, we're talking about people who are suggesting that someone who thinks that social justice can be an integral part of atheism are damaging and they're splitters and they're terrible people. I mean, that kind of rhetoric, which could very easily be applied to us, let's be honest here. Yep. Radio Free Thinker, you know, we don't really shy away from any topic. You know, it's a pretty silly argument to be made, and it's pretty silly to hear some pretty accomplished scientists and skeptics make that claim.
And I think this comes down to one of the parts that every movement and anyone who belongs and cares about a movement has to deal with, is the fact that, you know, when you look in the mirror sometimes, you don't always see the pretty. There is ugliness in there. As a movement, we need to acknowledge they're there, and we need to move on. We need to address them before we can really actively address the external ones, because these are very important issues. I am not in any way trying to make them less, and it's sad, but every movement needs to move on, it needs to grow, and it needs to have the strength to move on, because I would hate to see this diminish. And perhaps we should pause on that, maybe have a break, and then come back with some skeptic highlights.
The federal government is trying to ram through a set of electronic surveillance laws that will invade your privacy and cost you money. The plan is to force every phone and internet provider to surrender our personal information to authorities without a warrant. The worst part of their invasive, all-encompassing surveillance scheme is that you have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Send Ottawa a message by signing the petition at stopspying.ca. That's www.stopspying.ca. Thank you.
Well, we're right out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, so let's go to our skeptical highlights this week. And I have two skeptical highlights to tell you about. The first one is a CFI Vancouver lecture called Out of the Blogs and Onto the Streets: What Skepticism Can Learn from Social Movements. How apt, given our conversation. This is a lecture by Desiree Schell, who's the host of Skeptically Speaking, the podcast out of Edmonton. And it's taking place Friday, September 14th at 7 p.m. in room 1700 of SFU Harbor Center. And of course, Des will be talking about, well, organized skepticism. What can we learn from social movements? How can we affect change? How can we, so to speak, get out of the blogs, get onto the streets, and make our community more skeptical? It should be a great lecture. It's a suggested donation of $2 to $10, and it's hosted by CFI Vancouver. So you should come out and check that out. The other skeptical highlight that I have is also in the vein of skeptical activism. And this is a workshop presented by Desiree, as she's in Vancouver. And it's called Skeptical Activism with Desiree Schell, Saturday, September 15th at 2 p.m. in room 2245 at SFU Harbor Center. And Des will be going through a step-by-step interactive workshop about how to do effective skeptical activism. Des is a union organizer in her day job, so she's had a lot of experience with organizing movements and actually getting tangible social change. So she'll be giving a lecture or giving a workshop on how to go about doing that. Admission is $20 and includes a copy of Dez's guidebook, Skeptical Activism. So I encourage you to come out for that event as well.
I have a few skeptical highlights. Now, granted, these are all revolved around a topic important to me, philosophy. And actually, they're all philosophy cafe events. Wednesday, the 5th at 7 p.m., there is the Lives of Politicians, Private or Public. A number of politicians have had their careers prematurely cut short because of perceived or actual issues regarding their personal life. If the issue doesn't directly relate to their job, is this fair? Does it and should it? Should one's personal sort of morals and religious reflections be judged on their professional conduct? Jason Carrillo, who is a PhD student at SFU, will discuss this and find out, should we really care about the private lives of public politicians? This is going to be held at the Nature's Garden Organic Deli. That's 8968 University High Street in Burnaby. The admission is free. The second one is, what does it mean to be educated? This is by Sarah Fleming, who moderates a discussion on this. She's the Department of Linguistics at SFU. The current proliferation of learning resources delivered via technology may suggest that traditional schooling systems, including formal institutions and assessments, may become less relevant in the light of wide access to knowledge provided by the internet and the accompanying difficulties that traditional systems have kept up with the change. What does it mean to be an educated person in a modern society? Will formal education become even more important as a marker of social progress than it is now, or will education delivery become more flexible and less formal? A great example of this is my own self, is I am a huge fan of the Teaching Company. The Teaching Company offers a bunch of sort of university-style lectures on audio tape that people can download and listen to, but they're not like professional in the sense that they're from a university, but they're taught by professionals, expanding the way we learn things, and they're exploring this and its context in society. Now, this is happening tonight at 7 to 9 p.m. at the Unitarian Center. That's 949 West 49th Street here in Vancouver. Also free. Now, one that may be sort of related to this is Social Moguls, Social Virtuosos, Who Among Us is Capable of Driving Change? The world is always changing, usually according to the whim of politicians. But there are those who are shifting the balance in the direction of intention. For example, the blogger who takes on the news you return to time and again because they always seem to have the right scoop. A quality common to these virtuoso social actors or social moguls is knowing how to engage with others from more than one perspective and seeking meaningful compromise among the very different ways that others find value and meaning. Do you have these skills? Can you learn them? Can you walk in their shoes without, you know, using your own personal vision? Moderator Dr. Meg Holden, who is an associate professor of urban studies and geography at SFU, will make a discussion about this. This is going to be held Monday, September 10th at 7 p.m. at the Waves Coffee House. That's 900 Howe Street. It is also free. You know, Ethan, this might be a good thing for us and those who want to promote skepticism, atheism plus what have you, to go to.
We should go to that.
Yes. So I guess this is Dawn saying, eyes open, minds on.
And this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening and see you next week.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.